This is Brent. BrentAllenWinters.commonlawyer.com. www.commonlawyer.com. Briefly, I want to make a couple of points about what we call today the militia of the several states. Why do we call it that? Because our Constitution of the United States calls it that. And I want to talk about it from three perspectives, three points of view, namely, the point of view from the past, that's history, the point of view from the present, that's right now, and the point of view peering into the future. Now, as we look into the past, what we call today the militia of the several states of our United States, the history of it, from whence it has come, what we can see peering into the past, if we stare into the mist and the fog hard enough, what we can know about it, that is, about the militia, is lost in the fog of antiquity. But there are some things we can know. We know this, that men always everywhere, since the first progenitor, the first father of this race we call mankind, men have gathered themselves together, armed themselves with some kind of weapon, something that would enhance their ability to defend themselves, their friends, their neighbors, their families, from vicious and sordid brigands, thieves, murderers, plunderers, robbers, rapers, and invaders of every sort, whether invasion upon their little parcel of real estate, their village, or their country at large. But the culture from which our militia of the several states has bobbed forth came from those tribes. Our understanding of the militia came from those tribes that migrated to the island called Britain. They migrated from the northern coast about the north and the east side of the North Sea, but even more particularly, from that region now called Holstein at the base of what is today Denmark. From thence, the tribes that lived up onto that Jutland Peninsula called Denmark, and including the Celtic tribes from thence, thereabout, all of these at different times migrated to the island called Britain. And there they mixed, much more than they often like to admit, mixed their blood and their sensibilities, but all of them, says Algernon Sidney, had a religion, law, and government that was not only alike in generalities, but he said, and I'm quoting, strikingly alike in particulars. And that tradition of religion, law, and government we call today our common law. And our understanding of the militia of the several states has arisen from that tradition, that amalgamated, as it were, from those tribes, the Angles, the Saxons, the Jutes, that is, the Danes, and then later the Norwegians from Norway. What we call today our common law, they call the Volkreicht. Volkreicht means the right of the folk, F-O-L-K, we say today, the people's right. And a slice of that law, that tradition of religion, law, and government, was what we today call the militia. They called it the Ferd Fair. And even after they had migrated over to Britain and had been there for several centuries, they still called it, by their old Germanic tongue, Ferd Fair. Ferd, that's the band of armed men, and fair, we still use the word today, that means well going. Ferd Fair means the militia, a going. Just as we today say welfare, that means good going, and wayfare, that means good road. Or sometimes, if we go to the county fair, we call it the fair way, the way they want you to go. And Ferd Fair was the militia a going. In present-day American military parlance, they would say, we would say, the militia mobilized, or the militia underway. While on the island of Britain, the Anglo-Saxons, all of them, all the men, the males, remained armed, even when they were farming, and they farmed together. Their system of farming, of agriculture, was, what we would say today, highly developed, organized to the eye teeth, division of labor, who did what, when, where, and it was a successful system of agriculture. By the way, the fundamentals of it came to America. That's why we've been so productive in farming in America. But in those early days, everybody that worked out in the field brought their weapons with them and stacked them. Of course, they weren't firearms in those early days, but they stacked them up against a tree, and half of the men worked, and the other half remained armed. They didn't stack their weapons, and they took turns working and remaining armed, so that if brigands did attack, and they often did, just as the Indians attacked the settlers here in America by stealth while they were trying to farm Abe Lincoln's grandfather. That's how he died. Indians snuck up on him while he was trying to plow a field and murdered him. Well, it was the same situation in Britain. So they stayed armed. And the men that stayed armed, whatever group was that stayed armed at any particular time, it was their job to engage the attackers, the brigands, the robbers, the invaders, while the other ones gathered their weapons and joined the fray. That was the militia, the furred fare of the Angles, the Saxons, and the Jutes, and the Celts. Well, that tradition stayed in place. And through the centuries, way back from about the 5th century, when those tribes began to come in waves to the island of Britain, especially the Germanic tribes, the Celtic tribes had already arrived. But that tradition of the furred fare, the militia, of the Volk, the people, the able-bodied males, took on different forms here and there as the need arose, but remained, in principle, fundamentally the same. And when our forebears came to the United States, what is now the United States, the early Americas, the Puritan groups, beginning with that sect called the Pilgrims, the Puritans, the Anglicans, then the Scotch-Irish Presbyterians, and the German and Dutch Reformed groups, they all brought with them those common law sensibilities of the militia. Remember, the Dutch and the Frisians, yes, their tribes came from the base, about the base of that peninsula called Jutland, modern-day Denmark. And they all had the same kind of a tradition of religion, law, and government. Well, that came to America. It developed here for the next 150 years thereabouts until our country took up separation from Britain. And that tradition remained with us all through our history as a nation. When the Constitution of the United States was put forth for ratification, the states ratified it with a very compact but very precise law concerning our militia of the several states, how the militia of the several states was to function, its relationship with the general government in Washington, D.C., and each militia within each separate sovereign state, its relationship to its home state, and the government of it. Just 4 militia clauses, but compact, focused, and powerful. Only ancient Israel of old, in the writings of what we call the Older Testament, have had anything for a law of the militia in a common law sense that compares to our 4 militia clauses. And the last of those 4 militia clauses is what we today call the Second Amendment. Those militia clauses have been ignored for about 175 years, fulfilling the fears of many, including Justice Joseph Story, who that long ago wrote in his commentaries on the Constitution of the United States that his fear was that men would ignore those militia clauses here in America, and by doing so would lose not only the reality, but the politium. The politium, fancy word, means the badge of their freedom. The reality of their freedom and the badge of it, he saw it. Justice Joseph Story of a United States Supreme Court, he saw the militia of the several states to be the sign and reality, the reality itself, the teeth of our freedom. And anciently, from time past, able-bodied men full grown, and the ages have varied according to the sensibilities of people, but the Bible makes clear that age 20 is the age of maturity and responsibility. It is the age when a young man becomes a militiaman, whether he likes it or not. It's not an option if he's able-bodied to carry a weapon in battle. He is the militia, and even those that can't are a part of the militia in this sense. They are to serve as members of the jury when called upon to do so. You see, the duty of the militiaman, from the beginning and forward, has been twofold. And that twofold duty was the Volk Reich, the people's, the folks' responsibility. That's what that old Germanic word Reich means. Our word, R-I-G-H-T, is the same word. It means duty. And duty only arises out of law. And that twofold duty was to defend the land itself against invasion, the land itself, and especially foreign invasion by willingness to take up arms. That's the first duty, defense. And then the second duty is a companion duty, supportive of the first duty. In fact, both of those duties are the fundamental duties of government and are mutually supportive. The second duty is willingness to serve on the jury, which means a willingness in particular applications of particular cases, a willingness to defend the law of the land, willingness to take up arms, defense of the land, willingness to serve on the jury, defense of the law of the land, and to defend the one is to defend the other. That phrase, law of the land, arises out of Magna Carta. Magna Carta took it from our common law through the centuries, applied it in the form of a record in the Latin tongue. Magna Carta, Stephen Langton drafted it in Latin so that the Pope could read it to put him on notice that they weren't going to follow his law of the city. No, it was the law of the land in England. The law of the land, lex terra, Langton put it in Magna Carta. Lex, law, terra, land. And so today, our Constitution of the United States requires that all officers in state and the general government in Washington, D.C., take an oath to support and defend the Constitution of the United States. That's the law of the land. Against enemies foreign, that's willingness to take up arms, and enemies domestic, that's willingness to serve on the jury in defense of the law of the land. To take up arms in defense of the land, willingness to serve on the jury in defense of the law of the land. Those are the two duties of the militiaman, and those are the two fundamental duties of government. There aren't really that many more that true law gives men jurisdiction for. But without those, you have nothing of government. Well, what about the future? That was the past concerning the militia as we peered into the fog and mist of antiquity. Our Constitution of the United States lays down the law concerning our militia of the several states in the present day. And by the way, those brief four clauses, and you could add the clause that requires the oath, those clauses define nothing, and like all of our Constitution of the United States, depend upon our common law to inform their words and phrases. As Justice Taft observed, the men that drafted and ratified the Constitution of the United States wrote that document in compact, I'm quoting, compact draft. They defined only treason. They didn't define anything else, because the people that wrote it and the people that ratified it were awash, and breathed the air, the atmosphere of our common law. They didn't need an explanation. They lived it. Well, one more comment. What about the future of the militia of the several states? Well, remember what Justice Joseph Story said. The militia of the several states is not only the badge that our freedom is alive and well, it is also the reality that makes it possible. Those four militia clauses, and even what I would call the fifth one, the oath itself, because it is the oath of a militiaman, at common law, those clauses are now dormant. That's a fancy word that constitutional lawyers use to talk about a provision of our Constitution that is being ignored, dormant. What does dormant mean? It means asleep. I call them the sleeping militia clauses. The only one most folk know anything about is the Second Amendment. And that's a good thing. That's a good thing because it, that is the Second Amendment, doesn't grant any rights or responsibilities or duties at all. It simply recognizes a duty that our Maker has given all able-bodied males. No, it's not an option. It's a duty. Years ago, Granville Sharp, a Brit, studied extensively the militia as it was understood at common law, and he said, in all of the recorded history of the English-speaking people, there has never been a time that our common law did not require all able-bodied men to be armed, but not only to be armed. I'm quoting again. Why do I quote? Well, he who never quotes is never quoted, so allow me a quote. He said, there never was a time that our common law did not require that all able-bodied Englishmen not only be armed, but be expert at arms. So there you have it, friends, neighbors, and kin. Well, in light of all this, to put it in a well-known phrase of the prophets, how then shall we live? What shall we do? Well, as always, the answer, The answer to everything that we can do is do our duty. Duty arises out of law. The law of our Maker Himself requires us to defend the jurisdiction that He has bestowed upon each one of us individually, and therein lies the reason for the Second Amendment's recognition of that God-bestowed duty. Direct to man, the individual. No government did that. And then learn something about those other militia clauses, they're just a handful of them, and demand that those in office fulfill their duty, that those militia clauses delegate to them, all the while doing your duty, staying armed and taking time to be proficient, safe, in the use of a firearm. As Tom Jefferson put it, playing games with balls and watching other men play sports doesn't do much for body or soul like learning to use a firearm does. He said that. And he's right. There's true practical usefulness in that. This is Brent, Alan Winters, CommonLawyer.com, www.commonlawyer.com. And I encourage you to get a copy of the book, The Militia of the Several States, Our Constitution's Answer to Its Enemies, Foreign and Domestic. That's The Militia of the Several States, by yours truly, Brent Alan Winters. In the back of that booklet is a model state militia statute. Get it to your state legislator. Encourage him to use it, and his staff to use it, and your congressman to pass the legislation that the Constitution of the United States demands that these two bodies, the separate state legislatures and the Congress of the United States, pass legislation that these militia clauses demand, require, that these two legislative bodies set forth. No, they're not doing their duty, haven't for about 175 years. You can also find that book, by the way, in the form of a course concerning the militia of the several states. And National Liberty Alliance has taken that book and offered a course, using that book as a small textbook to prime your mind concerning those four militia clauses. Putting those four militia clauses in action under the authority, the concurrent jurisdiction, as our understanding of constitutional law in America puts it, under the authority of the governor of your state, or when the president of the United States calls forth the militia or any part of it under the authority of the president of the United States, and part, therefore, at that point, of the armed forces of the United States. Those that drafted and ratified our Constitution did not creatively of their own minds come up with this themselves, no. This is our common law tradition, stretching back for centuries and lost, its origins lost in the fog of antiquity. www.commonlawyer.com